Gentlemen, brethren, I'm very pleased to be here to attempt to share with you, to express to you the understanding that I have through the research project, A Study of Generations, about the Lutheran population, what in fact is there. I don't intend to go into great detail in terms of the scientific methods or the techniques used in the project, nor do I intend to snow you or overwhelm you with lots of statistics. I could do that, but my judgment is that would be neither very fruitful for you nor for me. Rather, it's my intention to deal as cogently and clearly as possible with the implications, the sort of conclusions or the suggestions that might be drawn from the information that we gathered in the summer of 1970. That information consists of the responses of approximately 5,000 people from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the ALC, and the LCA in a random sample to an 740-item questionnaire that gives us from 7 to 10 million bits of information, which we have then used the most advanced and sophisticated analytic techniques possible to summarize. A basic point that needs to be clear is that now when I talk about the shape which this data took, the information, when I talk about the shape of people's responses or the kinds of dimensions that we discovered, that was not any arbitrary nor a priori judgment on the part of the researchers, myself, Milo Brecky, or Merton Strumman, but rather that it is the patterns of responses from the 5,000 individuals that gives shape and form to what we have termed scales or dimensions. And out of the mass of information, we can now summarize it more adequately or better and deal with it principally in terms of 78 dimensions or groups of items or kinds of responses that, again, the way people answered caused to take shape. Not any kind of arbitrary nor a priori decision on our part. The first, and possibly to me personally, the most important thing or the most exciting thing that comes out of this mass of information is the clear and solid indication that what we have talked about in Lutheran theology for some 450 years, namely law and gospel, is not just whistling Dixie in some theological ivory tower, but rather does have direct, specific, and unique effects in the lives, the hearts, and the minds of persons. That in fact, what we have termed and judged and written and talked about as law and gospel represent a fundamental reality in the minds and hearts of individuals. Possibly there is no other single conclusion as strongly supported in the entire field of research in religion as the understanding that there are two basic types of religious experience, or two basic stances with which people hold their religious convictions, exhibit their religious behaviors, and maintain their religious identity. Other researchers have long understood this to be the case. A variety of names have been given to these two types of religious experience or stance. They have been called by Gordon Allport extrinsic an intrinsic religion by Spilka and Allen, committed and consensual religion, what we feel we have added to that well-supported conclusion in research in religion is the ability clearly to identify extrinsic or consensual religion with what Lutheran theologians have termed a law religion, or the practical atheism that the 16th and 17th century Lutheran dogmaticians spoke of. In fact, if one looks at the theological literature of the Lutheran Church, where there is a description of the consequences in individual lives, or description of the kinds of persons who manifest a law religion, that description fits almost exactly the dimensions that we now find in the summer of 1970 coming out of the responses of some 5,000 individuals to the questionnaire that we devised. To me, that's exciting, meaningful, significant. It says a very basic and fundamental thing about you and me, our work, and our calling. It says that it has meaning, true and real meaning, in the lives of the individuals whom we serve. It says that we are not somehow irrelevant first or 16th century superstitious fools, but that we have a way of understanding, touching, and dealing with the reality of individuals alive at this moment and at this time. It is the case that out of our data, the concept or construct of a religion that is law-based or law-oriented, and the kind of religious experience attendant upon that sort of religious stance is clearer. It's more solid empirically in terms of our data than the obverse, that is a gospel orientation. But we'd expect that. We would have some difficulties, I think, with operationally defining what it means to live under the gospel. That makes more problems for us than what it means to live under the law. This morning, I wish to limit myself primarily to a discussion of what the data says about living under the law and the way in which I understand the dynamics. That is, how it works inside a person to know only the law. Our confession states that the law always accuses, condemns, judges, and kills. And indeed, that's what we find to be the experience of those who live under the law. For the most salient feature, as one looks at all of this data, and I've lived with it now for some 3.5 years, you look at all of this data, what is most powerfully voiced from the responses of those persons whose religious experience is limited to law is the pain, the terror, the fear, the anxiety. For every possible measure of alienation, isolation, meaninglessness, normlessness, anomy, pessimism that was possible has a positive correlation with the kind of religious stance that clearly identifies a person who knows only the demands of the law.
every possible dimension of hostility, prejudice, resistance, judgmental attitude toward other persons that could come out of our difference is positively related with the experience of knowing only the demand of the law. How does that work? This is the way I understand it. That the accusation of the law is, very simply put, you cannot be what you are, you must be what you cannot be. You can't be what you are, simple. You have to be what you can't be. Perfect. The person who hears that in all of his life, to whom, as Luther says, every creature of God, the leaves, the wind, the animals, every creature of God is an alien and hostile enemy. So that in all of life, that accusation is present. There's no way for such an individual to experience anything other than pain and terror. The process by which that occurs, as I perceive it now, is that the law sets up within us the system of counting. It gives to life the quality, if X, then Y. It imposes upon life a basic conditional experience. And this is, I think, clearly expressed in, for example, the conclusion to the commandment that God shows mercy to thousands of them that love him and keep his commandments, but those who do not experience punishment. If X, then Y. How do we meet the if X, then Y? We have to count. We start to measure. The system of counting or measure is what the law creates within us. And that system is what's important, not what is counted, not what is measured. It can be anything, and frequently it is anything or even everything. But as long as counting occurs, a man is going to find out that it's not enough. Thorndike's famous statement, Thorndike was one of the premier psychologists in the 20s and 30s, his statement was, if anything exists, it exists in quantity. If it exists in quantity, it can be measured. Me, that's a clear statement of what the law imposes upon human life, the emphasis upon quantity. Today, I'm sure you've all heard of B.F. Skinner and his program of behavioristic modification of behavior or control of society and human engineering. B.F. Skinner's whole system very clearly, the law. It's the law made scientific. Reward and punishment. If X, then Y. And the rewards of the law. That's all that B.F. Skinner's work is. If a pigeon pecks at a disc, to be followed by a gift or benison of water or grain, or a light that then can be a signal, or however it might be. That's simply the promise. If X, then Y. And to the extent that B.F. Skinner today is saying what he does about men and their nature and the quality of their life, I understand him like Balaam's ass, whether he wills it or no, to be compelled to be doing the will of God to be preaching the law. And indeed, there is nothing more powerful in our society today that constitutes the accusation of the law over against man and his sinful nature than that kind of very hard-nosed, apparently hard-nosed, empirical science. So I say 3 cheers for Skinner. Let him go at it. It'll make it much easier for me and you to preach the gospel, I think. Accounting as a system, as a psychotherapist, this is what I observe in all kinds of people. Take the matter of sexual behavior. You have Masters and Johnson and their research institute and treatment center here in the city. What are they concluding now about sexual behavior? In addition to what they did to count, by the way, which is about as far as you can go with the law, to count things like color, hue, intensity, and so on. They're concluding that the seat or source of sexual problems that they treat, what we've been saying for a long time, this is nothing new for Masters and Johnson, but their term is performance anxiety. That sexual problems which they treat and resolve have to do with the fact that people start to count things. And as long as it's counting something, whatever it is, you're going to have some problems. Whether it's length of penis, or length of coitus, or frequency of orgasm, or frequency of coitus, or success in being open and free, or number of lovers, whatever it might be, as long as you're counting, there is no way that you can avoid the question of performance. Do I measure up? Do I, in fact, reach the standard that I ought to reach? The judgment of the law assures always that what you experience is that it's too short. Never enough. But again, please be clear, my understanding is that it's not what is counted, but rather the system of counting. For what gets counted can range from achievement to height to fatness to beauty to how open, how free, how honest one is. I had a patient, a very brilliant law professor, who had established a very creditable professional academic achievement level. But at age 35, his wife divorced him. And by the time he became a patient, he was engaged in some pretty heavy anogenic drinking, very depressed, suicidal, and so on. And in talking about this, at one point, he put it this way. They, I'm going to put the they in quotation marks, they promised me that if I did good things and worked hard, I would have a good life. And so I did good things, and I worked hard. And I was editor of the Law Review, and I was on a prestigious law firm, and I have a prestigious post. And I've written good articles, and I've been a good husband. Damn it, they lie. What have I got now? Nothing. The rule didn't work. Fundamentally, that's the experience of living only under the law. It promises, and it promises good things. And for a time, we may be able to experience good things under the law. For there is reward. There is a relationship. But the trap is that it never delivers what we in fact need. Thirsty, release from the system of counting or measuring ourselves. A young woman was extremely depressed, very troubled. After several years in the whole sensitivity, awareness, openness movement, lots of group kinds of experiences, heavy involvement in the civil rights, anti-war movement, had all the right things, all the right attitudes, all the conventional wisdom, a bright, competent young woman in college, was absolutely crushed when, at an anti-war planning meeting, one of her co-workers said to her, this is all just a phony head trip for you. That's the worst thing you can commit now. See, that's the worst thing you can commit now. To be on a head trip. To be phony. Not on. Again, note the consistency of measurement and counting. The category of sin or the content of what is regarded as sin or evil might change, but not the system. There is still the experience of not measuring up. It's not enough. Never is it enough. The consequences of this are clear in our data. For when it's never enough, when it is always too short, you have no sense of yourself. No, to use a psychological term, no real ego. Werner Ehlers puts it this way, that the ego or the self is reduced to a mathematical point by the accusation of the law. And a mathematical point is empty and hollow. It has no substance, no shape. So what do? You try desperately to borrow identity, to borrow or to see structure and shape for yourself from anything outside of you, whether it's a group or a structure like a church or a government or rules of behavior that are a part of the society's mores and norms, or expectations about the way roles are to be played. What you're doing is trying to borrow for yourself some shape and form to give yourself identity. Like the insect. Inside, very soft and jelly-like. The skeleton is outside. It's an exoskeleton. To live under the law means that you have to have such an exoskeleton. So the salient dimension of the law orientation in our data is a resistance to change and hostility to change. Keep things the way they are. Preserve the rules of the game that I know. No, I'm not winning the game, but at least the rules are comfortable and I know what they are, and keep those rules solid. Keep the family, particularly, the way it is. Do not change anything about family life or the society's life. And now, how are those structures understood? They're understood again in terms of performance. How do you measure up to what you are expected to do in the family, in the government, in the country, and within the church? Along with that goes a very heavy commitment to a psychological rigidity, an absoluteness. And one of the characteristics of persons whose religious experience is to live under the law is that their statements, just the form of their statements, are almost invariably in absolute. So if we have a number of items where people respond on a 7-point scale, persons who in other ways indicate a reliance upon the law as their religious experience are going to pile up at the extreme. And that follows through all the way, always on the extreme, always the absolute shape or form. Always is an absolute in itself. But that seems to be the way it is. Very seldom any kind of acceptance of an ambiguity, a grayness, little ability to tolerate ambiguity, and a strong need or drive for certainty. What it means to live under the law, then, also includes a rejection or hostility toward other people. I'm sure that many of you have heard in the past years the charge that Christian orthodoxy causes prejudice, particularly anti-Semitism. In fact, it's a curious thing that causal claim advanced by some other social science researchers has been heeded almost only in the church. There's almost a masochistic sad evidence in that within the profession, as you need confirm for yourself only by reading the professional review of that sort of research, there's been little attention paid to it, and it's been regarded as not convincing, not sound. But at any rate, we attempted to replicate that in our study. And what we have found is that far from orthodoxy being associated in any way with high levels of prejudice, what is associated with prejudicial, harsh, judgmental attitudes toward other people is to believe only in law, or what we have termed mystery. Not orthodoxy as it is. To me, it makes sense in this way. When I'm reduced to a mathematical point in terms of myself under the accusation of the law, and I'm attempting to borrow, to steal, to seize identity for myself, to give shape and form to my life in some way from outside, then the group, whatever, again, dimension I'm measuring the group on, the group to which I belong, the group to which I give my allegiance because it gives me some identity. That becomes important, significant. I need that group, whether I'm defining that group in terms of the persons who drive a certain kind of car, who drink a certain kind of martini, who have a certain level of IQ, or who live in a certain area of town, or who have a certain color of skin. However, the reference group that I am using at any given moment is determined. In other words, however, again, I'm counting. Makes no difference. But as long as I'm identifying a group, counting something, and that group has importance to me because I need it to know who I am, then anybody other than that group is going to have problems with me, or I'm going to have problems with them. In order to keep my group demarcated, denoted, clearly set apart so I know who I am, I have to put those other people outside of me. I'm very much aware of, and very sympathetic to, the struggles that you're going through. I've heard again lots of that today. plead, ask that you take courage in the struggle, that you take heart in your work and in your labor, in view of the potential great importance and significance of what's happening here. The struggle is real. It has a substantive issue involved in it. I can only pray, God, that all of you, students and faculty alike, receive this message of the Holy Spirit so that the saying and what is said reflects the will and the revelation of God. I was asked to take about 40 minutes and speak on this. I've done so. Now I'm asked to allow for some discussion. Yes, sir. All right, first, in terms of age as a variable that accounts for something, there are different patterns that age has effect. At no point, however, does it ever account for more than 12% of the variance. And in many ways, you can say age is a proxy variable. Now, what does age mean? What is age? What does it stand for? Is it simply chronology? No. Age is really a proxy variable for something else. What it's proxy for is what a person believes, perceives, values at whatever age he is. That's what it's really it's a substitute for that. And that's being recognized in professional literature now. So that age as a singular or unitary variable is not highly regarded. It's not regarded that way anymore. But in terms of our data, yeah, only about 12% at most. In terms of the question of the authority of Scripture, it would be true. There's a tendency for slightly larger numbers of young people to have problems with the authority of Scripture than for older people. But it's not age that makes a difference. It's rather the view of the authority of Scripture. We have a sample from another study involving about 8,000 youth, and an ecumenical sample including Jews, Eastern Orthodox, Southern Baptists, Young Life, Youth for Christ, LVE and LYE, you know, all kinds of people. And there is, when we look at that, there is a higher degree of acceptance of the authority of Scripture or reliance upon Scripture as revelatory among Lutherans than among other groups, even Southern Baptists. Yes, sir. We do in several ways. We do in that at least
three of the previous research instruments that we used have been validated in cross-cultural studies. We do in that a number of the scales that we have used from previous YRC research have been validated in Indonesia and India, again in cross-cultural settings. We do in that, again, we specifically look for ways in which we might find effects attributable to the proclamation of the church that are independent of the culture, and we have at least a couple of those. But to give you an example of the cross-cultural stuff we do have, we use Henry Morris's item in the University of Chicago, where he, in 1947, 48, and 49, obtained large samples of college-age young people from mainland China before the communists took over, from India, Japan, Scandinavia, Italy, Argentina, United States, Canada, Egypt. I'm forgetting one. Did I say Scandinavia? Yeah. Well, anyway. By large samples, I mean several thousand, not small things. Analyzing all of that across cultures, he found what he called value orientations that are cross-cultural or subcultural, that exist independent of culture. He termed these value orientations desire for a dependable world, desire for a controllable world, and desire for detachment from the world. We used his items, used more sophisticated techniques, and found exactly the same three value orientation among American Lutherans in the summer of 1970, which leads us to conclude that here is something that tells us the Lutheran farmer waking up at Russell, Kansas in the morning may well have the same kind of view of what the good life is, the same desire for his world to be the same as it was when he went to bed at night as the Hindu camel driver, or the Buddhist physicist. It's one cross-cultural kind of information we have. That, secondly, in terms of the kinds of dimensions that have to do with belief in God, and let's say more Christian kinds of things, the same dimensions that appeared in the study of generations, some of them at least, also appeared in a study done by Paul Peterson of Asian youth in Indonesia and in India, Burma too, I believe, where he translated the items and we did the research, we did the analysis, and you get the same kind of thing. The same items, form, dimensions, etc. And thirdly, when we look for what the gospel means to people in their lives, we find that throughout the whole population, across the whole country, in a random sample, that is independent of age or education or any other kind of thing, we get a consistent response to some items that Del Schultz helped us work up in terms of how people would live out the gospel in their life situation. We regard that as indication that the culture does not have a massive overall effect upon the church, that there's something the church has that goes beyond culture. Mm-hmm.
Let me tag into your question. Culturally, though, you're dealing on the evidentiary plane. Americans are prone to accept the kind of evidence which is empirical. If I am prone only to accept empirical kind of evidence, then it seems to me I'm going to have to take all kinds of claims and run it through that screen, even if it isn't appropriate screen to run it through, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I have in the back of my mind the argument that went on in philosophy with the logical positivist who said, anything which is not empirically verifiable is nonsense. And then one of them, Wittgenstein, came up with the conclusion that that statement was nonsense and could not be held.
Mm-hmm.
because it was not empirically verifiable, mm-hmm. and that the kind of language you are using is appropriate for various kinds of what he calls games. There's a scientific language game, an empirical kind of data is appropriate for that. There is a moral language game, where you have ought kind of language, and that's appropriate for that. There is a religious language game, for which religious language is appropriate, and when one starts mixing the empirical kind of thing into there, you are getting yourself into a logical kind of bond. Could it not be that the American cultural prone to accept only that empirical kind of thing and want to run even data which is not particularly appropriate for that through that sort of thing? I didn't hear any of the cross-cultural things that you were talking about relate to the evidentiary claim on which you were focusing.
Right. The linguistic analytic task has reached a dead end too, and at least as I understand where the philosophers are now, the language game thing has been seen to be somewhat of a dead end. if I read the philosophers right now, at least some of you may know more about this, but what I've been reading is almost a recrudescence of Anselm's ontological argument. There are even five articles in the Festschrift attributed or written for Herbert Feigl that deal with Anselm's ontological argument. I think it's very strange the Festschrift was the only surviving original logical positivist. Yeah, five people writing about Anselm. Even Imre Lakatos, the current hotshot philosopher of science, writes about Anselm. I don't know where I'm going. I suppose I'm trying to say, in terms of the evidentiary claim, I don't think that can be avoided by the language game series now, or the question raised by it. It's still very simply a matter of how do I know what there is? Epistemology. And it's true, Americans tend to have a bias toward the empirical, but that's true of everyone affected by scientific naturalism. Among our respondents, persons who are most affected, who are most likely to say things like, there is nothing which science cannot eventually understand, that science makes a greater contribution to human life than the arts and humanities. The persons most likely to make those kind of statements are persons who, in terms of their religion, are living under the law, sort of legalistic. They're the ones who are paying more attention to that kind of evidence or are settling the evidence they claim on that basis. In terms of those who are clear on the gospel, there is not as heavy a reliance upon empirical things. Have I responded to you?
Yeah, but if I understand you right, then you are saying I should take the biblical material in a non-empirical way.
No, I'm not trying to say what you should do. I'm trying to describe the situation for you, give you my understanding, in terms of my awareness of what's going on inside people. And I'm asking, in terms of what is being said, for you to do the theological test. Okay?
Several years ago, there was a book entitled Changing Values in College, which seemingly gave us the impression that college education is actually a reference to the value system of a person. Do you have any evidence through this study to show this kind of thing in relationship to different groups, what their values are? Does college education make any difference to the value system of religion?
None of the kinds of studies that attempt to get at shifts across time can really do that, John, because they're all to make the cross-sectional study. They look at lots of people at one point in time. Ours is the same kind of data. If we wanted to answer that question, really we'd have to do a longitudinal study, follow the same people through a college education. Where that has been done, yes, it is the case that a college education seems to result in a shift in values, and the shift tends to be away from any kind of religious dogma or doctrine toward a secular humanism. Yes. No, because it's not a longitudinal study. We do find that when we look at those persons who are in the college age group, yes, that's where there is a higher proportion of persons who will espouse a secular humanism. Right.
The problem that you're putting forward seems to think at least from my understanding around what our Western dislike of paradox. If that's the case, that the Eastern mind would seem to have a lot more ease at dealing with paradox and things, especially in terms of that yin yang kind of thing. From the point of view of psychology and religion, what was this view of reality which can accept paradox? Does that have anything that can help us do this? To a resolution or partial attempt at resolving this problem that we put before?
I'm not that well versed in the Eastern religion, and there has not been a great deal of investigation in the psychology of religion that would say much about that. There has been of late considerable research in this country on individuals here who have attempted or have gone into one form or another of Eastern religion or have formed mystical communities of one sort or the other. And what's happening in that kind of research, I just read a report from a fellow that spent 6 months with a commune in mystic commune in New England, a pre-publication type report, that it's being understood and explained in psychological terms, that all of the phenomena at least tend to be reduced to psychology. And the paradox holding that you refer to, at least in what I've seen from this country, people into Zen Buddhism, etc., is viewed as denial or cognitive dissonance reduction. That's the way it's understood. I don't know if that says anything to your question. I'm not that aware of Eastern religion. But what is being done here in the area of psychology of religion tends to see it as not as explainable psychologically. Yes, sir.
Pardon me, my short answer is, could you once more repeat those three cross-cultural things that you mentioned before?
In basic value orientation,
desire for
a dependable world, desire for a controllable world, and desire for detachment from the world. Yes, sir. I'm not trying to say what I think the theologian should do. That would be presumptuous. I am trying to say that on the basis of what we find here, we can locate, I think, in the psychology of religion, a problem that as of right now, we still have most of our people believing, but the majority of those who would still believe appear not to be willing to make the truth claim that, yes, what I believe is in fact the case. That's how I account for the curious paradox that we have Lutheran saying Jesus is the only way of salvation. And the only way, no other way, which is sort of central to what we've been teaching, and we're glad about that. But we also have many of the same people saying all religions are the same, that we shouldn't try to change other people, that we do not really need to send missionaries out, that that's sort of foolishness, and so on. That's what I read as indicating a difference. The only way I can understand what's happening there, and when the time we wrote the book, I just didn't have much sense. I could say, well, what's going on? Now, the way I'm understanding it is in this fashion. There's the belief claim, not the truth claim. And I'm attempting to say to you as preachers, to the theologians, I regard this as a serious problem. How long are people going to maintain a belief that is not tied to reality in some way? If they maintain it too long, and it gets too far divorced from reality, from the claim that that's what's real, then somebody sooner is going to call me in and say, okay, psychologist, with your diagnostic skills, what malady does this person have? And at that point, if I'm being faithful to my psychology, I'm likely to say, this is a person suffering from hallucinations and delusions. That's the problem I'm trying to describe. I'm not trying to say what should be done about it. Yes, sir?
What kind of technology do you use when you talk about the truth claim, or that something is real or in fact? It seems that you're using empirical or objective technology.
Yeah, I would hope that I would be classified as a realist. That's an ontological statement, huh? Yeah, that can be done. Bishop Berkeley did that. Everything is ideal, subjective. It's a matter of my belief. I think pure idealism, however, has tended not to be very successful. And it just hasn't lasted very long. There is an indication, yes, that it does work for them. It's important to them that there is an emotional affect level to it. But, yeah, it has meaning. I don't know that we have anything that would say that they're willing to buy that as a base for reality. That subjective experience defines reality. I just don't think we have information on that. No. Yeah. Same.
I'm clear about some things.
distinction between the late time and the good time. And really, that's what said in the beginning, that people's behavior was influenced by what they believe. I'm not sure as to which of those categories you use. It is the late time, it's kind of telling how they live, or the good time, it's not definitely both.
And in terms of the first portion, I attempted to establish that a growing understanding that beliefs and values are important determinants. Yeah. That's generally held to be to include the whole system of beliefs, which in, it has the belief claim, evidence claim, truth claim. Yeah. The problem that we have, as I perceive it from our data, is that for Lutherans, and if you want to extrapolate to Christians generally, there is this divergence. And I'm asking, in view of what looks like a future emphasis upon belief, I see that as a serious problem. For if we, I'm making a judgment, if we don't pay attention to that divergence right now, we're going to find ourselves in an age of emphasis upon belief, where beliefs other, some kind of other belief than what we've been proclaiming is likely to be the predominant one. Does that help? No, I'm not saying that. But different kinds of belief, including whatever the belief is, whatever the evidence for it is, and whatever positive or whatever level of truth claim is made, different kinds of belief produce different kinds of behaviors. And that the content of the belief, including all three levels, all three logical levels, is what's now being held to be important. Then I suppose if we're going to stay in business, I think we need to pay attention to what looks to be a problem in our day.
Well, it looks as if some of the persons here are a little anxious about the chronologic which is taking over, and perhaps this would be a good place then to cut off the discussion and look forward to the to whom for this evening's discussion, the four typologies which you listed seem to me to be pretty interesting, and maybe we'll find out what kind of evidentiary claim appeals to which ones of those. So for now, we thank you for your time and attention, and Ralph for his presentation, and we hope we'll see a good many of you this evening.
I can look at the other group, and I can say, when the law accuses me, well, don't tell me I'm such a bad guy after all. Look at those poor bastards over there. They're worse than I am. They're worse. So I'm not so bad after all. The people who are better than I am, they make problems for me too, and constitute a reproach and a judgment against me. So either way it goes, group other than that which I am using for my reference group become the object of my hostility, resistance, and fear. And so in the law orientation we find the dimensions of generalized prejudice that people who know only the law and for whom religion is only the accusation of the law, are the ones most likely to say, poor people would get ahead if only they worked hard. See, all those people on welfare wouldn't need to be on welfare, just get out and get a job. But black people could get ahead too, if they just work and so on. Or that Jews are trickier than other businessmen. Jews always want to be at the head of things. That's it. When it comes to prejudice or discrimination or hostility toward other people, by the way, among the Lutheran population as a whole, what is most clearly and powerfully the area where hostility toward others is found has to do with styles of life and radical political stances, not with race or religion, but rather with people whose lifestyles are markedly different from my own, or whose political views are markedly different from my own. Those are the two kinds of people that Lutherans on the whole will be most resistant to, and particularly those who are primarily living only under the law. Then comes the pain. For then come the dimensions of alienation, isolation. When we separate out, again using some of the methods of the chant, that group of persons most clearly expressing an orientation toward the law and the conviction that God judges them depending upon their behavior or their sincerity of belief, we separate out that group that is clearly most heavily committed to that, and we look then at all the items, we find very interesting things. That out of that group, 40% will say, I frequently think of suicide, as opposed to less than 5% of the others. We find, for example, that out of the group of persons who are most heavily identified with the law and experiencing most of the pain of judgment, we almost exhaust those persons who reported that they engaged in homosexual behavior within the last year. You read Romans 1, that's very clear. What does it say about homosexuality? It says that for those persons who change the truth of God into a lie and worship and serve the creature more than the Creator, God gives them over to their own lust, including homosexual behavior. And out of the some 47 persons, a little bit more than 1%, who indicated in our questionnaire that they had engaged in homosexual intercourse within the past year, almost all of that group were included in the number of those who find the law most acute, most judging, most painful, as you would expect from Romans 1. The pain also is expressed. The frustration is expressed in terms of when you commit yourself to living by the rules and they don't deliver, as Marty suggests in his book, Varieties of Unbelief. That's where you're going to get what he terms anomie, that is, an hostility and an anger towards the law itself, a refusal to accept the judgment of God, a refusal to listen to the law in any of its claims. And that's precisely what we find. For the same thing is that along with this high commitment to living by the rules, doing good things, working hard, being good, right, honest, you know, all of that stuff's a part of it. Also goes the attitude, but you have to be a little bit bad to get ahead today. It's all right to break the law a little bit. Then if you just don't get caught. But I have no moral reason to delay the gratification of anything that I want right now. And in fact, that if I do delay gratification of my wants, I will become an erotic personality. That getting ahead today, getting gratification of what one wants, depends upon luck or fate, or a little bit of conniving, a little bit of cheating around the edges. Those are all part of the anime expressed in the lives of those who most clearly experience the judgment of the law. And in fact, that anger, that hostility and rejection of the law itself shows also in their behavior. For again, while our data constitutes self-report of behavior, and it's not observed behavior, nevertheless, it is significant that in terms of what we term questionable personal activity, gambling, fighting, drinking, lying, frequent fighting in the family, extramarital petting, extramarital intercourse, drunkenness, and so on, that those persons highest in saying, yes, this has been in my life frequently or occasionally in the past year, are those persons who most likely and most clearly live under the law and experience the accusation of the law. When we do, by the way, an analysis, a three-way analysis of variance to try to find out what affects what on that issue, and include age, because we do have some indication that the younger people are, the more they're messing around, the more they're showing a wild oats of real determinant. So we check out, is it age or is it law and gospel? What we find is they all have an effect, but they're independent effects. There's no interaction. So we can't say that it's simply youthful age that is leading to this higher level of questionable personal activity. It is also, by the pretty well established, that living under the law is just as effective in producing this kind of questionable personal activity as is youthful age. Incidentally, you may get some amusement, I guess. That's always a typical view. One of the first things we found in this area, that by using the very complex methods we did, five independent methods of factor analysis, two independent methods of homogeneous keying, and reciprocal averaging, and all that kind of stuff, you know, very complex, to try to find out items that go together, we got one little group of three items that show a high reliability, over 80, 4.80. So there's very, very high level of consistency. The person who said yes to one of these three items said yes to the other two. The three items were within the past year, I have engaged in frequently or occasionally in extramarital petting or extramarital intercourse, and I was drunk. Which typically, here's the scientific confirmation of the passage in Proverbs. Put knocked off on the wine, and it moved itself in the cup, and it stirred itself aright. For then on eye shall behold strange women, and my mouth shall utter perverse things. That's the way it happened. If you ever doubted it, I can prove it to you scientifically now. So that is part of the pain of living only under the law. We find also those persons who most clearly are committed to the concept of work righteousness, meeting the demand, for example, also report having the fewest friends. We give people a chance to tell us how many close friends they have, from no close friends up to eight or more. And a much higher proportion of the persons who clearly live under the law said, I have no friends. than in any of the other groups. They have less contact with the community, less contact with the church. They are, in fact, no matter how you look at it, much more isolated, alone, and frightened. Strong statement this is made, again, by those who most clearly live under the law. The first thing I think of when I wake up in the morning are all the dangers in the world. All the bad things that can happen during the day. I suppose for me, living with this whole body of data as I have, that's one of the more poignant kinds of things that I find coming through, teaching out of the responses of these 5,000 persons. It's important to me, for in my judgment, and it's only my own personal judgment, within the church as I have known, we have not tended to take into account the pain and the anguish of living only under the law. When we have attempted, as I have experienced it, for the most part at least, to deal with works righteousness, we've come across basically with another club saying, you know, you shouldn't be what you are, namely, works righteousness. You should be gospel believing Christian. How we have excoriated the Pharisees. They're a black hat. Look at what has been written in Concordia Pulpit, or CTM, how we've handled this whole thing. And look for the message that's given, not the word, but the message. And most frequently, as I judge it to be a case, the message has been another expression of the demand, you can't be what you are. Seldom have I seen it paying emotional attention to the kind of pain which I can now say clearly is part of living under the law. There may indeed be, and there is a group of persons in our data too, a human capacity to tame the law. Yeah, we've got that. We've got a group of people, I'll talk about that group tonight, who domesticated. But lost its shape, got no bite anymore. And there, it was seen as if the pain is not likely to be present. But from our data, I can say it's there, but it's more subtle. And it has to do principally with sense of meaning and purpose in life. For those persons who have successfully domesticated the law, so that its demand does not evoke massive guilt in lots of areas, more than any other group, have great difficulty understanding what their life is for, what it's aimed at, where it's going, and are more likely to say, when given the chance, if I had 9 more lives, I would choose to live all of them just like the one I have lived, or I choose to live none of them. Persons who have apparently tamed the law, I like to say, I don't want to live anymore. I've had enough. Just no more. Or to have greater inclination to say, there is no direction or purpose or meaning in my life. So I think that says, yeah, it looks like you can domesticate the law, but it bites your heart in the end somewhere. It'll get it. It doesn't do. I think at this time I'd like to stop and provide some chance for any questions or interactions.
How would you define the term law?
My understanding of that is that the law is the basic quality of human experience that we are responsible for, the demand, it precedes Sinai. It has nothing to do with the Ten Commandments. I would try to define it in terms of Romans 5, where Paul talks about the law having existed before Sinai, and says that curious thing, I can't put it exactly right offhand, but the curious thing about the law somehow causing sin, what is that? I had not known sin except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. That somehow there's a causal relationship between the law and sin. So that's how I would understand law to be. I'd include that. In terms of defining, I wouldn't say it is, in terms of defining law, that I rely most upon Ehlers' definition. It is the fundamental demand that men experience simply by being men.
Took out the law because they want to hear it, and those
that
took out the gospel because they're ready to hear it, and I can be preaching the gospel and the law.
Right. Right. In terms of the psychology of what's happening, I would say, yes, the person who in our data clearly shows a commitment to believing in works righteousness, to living under the law, is going to be hearing law. Right. Whether you think you're preaching it or not. And that's simply one of the psychological realities. We know that from all kinds of other things. Not just a matter of the law, but as long as it's there and it's there naturally, and it is the natural religion of man, which we've always maintained, yes. And that makes a problem for you as a pastor. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes, the obverse would be true, and that we find in that group that I think we have a basis for saying, certainly while we don't want to categorize individuals, we recognize that this is a dynamic thing. The whole law gospel tension has always been viewed as a very dynamic process, never static. So when we don't want to categorize individuals in terms of our data, we can say there are those who have their hearts, their faces turned more toward the gospel. And that group, yes, will be able to hear proclamation of the gospel. Yes, thank you.
We can see then that the more rigidly organized institution will attract more law-oriented people. You said something here before about that we continue to put institution and so forth, let it down.
I would not say that our data would have support for saying the more rigidly organized the institution is, the more likely it will attract law-oriented persons. Again, I think those who seem clearest from our data to have some grasp of the gospel are not antinomian. Another important point, I hope I'm not coming across as an antinomian. That's not the case. The person who do understand the gospel in our data and give evidence of that in what they say dogmatically and their beliefs, their emotions and their behavior and all those dimensions, do not show any hostility toward the law. They would fit the psalmist's description of persons who can say the law of God is like fine gold, like drawn honey. It's pure and just. They're not antinomian. That group of persons is going to be able to live under and live within a structure, an institution that may be rigidly organized. I think, however, we do need to pay attention to how we may structure things. That does have an effect. For example, in my home parish, as I think would be the case in many modes of authority, when it comes to getting people from the teaching of truth to the communion of. How does that work? What's the structure set up? The structure set up is ushers, lines, and there's a clear pattern. Very clear pattern. Now the ushers direct you. So you let it go. You should walk around the lecture this way, not go across in front of it. And when you get up from having received the sacrament, you can turn a certain way, and everybody turn the same way, and they go off with all the interests of decency and order. But what happens when one person turns the wrong way? You can feel it, visibly. You can feel it. The cross, you know, the sudden body tension. My God, I haven't done the right thing. And as a psychologist, I would say most likely then we have wiped out any psychological experience of forgiveness and grace that may have occurred at the sacrament. Listen.
How and what point were the mechanics involved in this?
I want to say something about that in the second part, but in terms of content, content of faith, I think we have a rather strong suggestion in our data. That an awareness of the humanity of Jesus is a possible cause or the possibly most effective way to move people from, or let's say, from a primary law orientation to a gospel orientation. One of the things that's very clear in our data is that Lutherans, on the whole, as a group, do not have a grasp of either the unity of the two natures of Jesus nor of his human nature. That Lutherans, if we want to use the ancient heretical labels, would be docetists and Nestorians. No, monarchists. Anyway, they separate the two natures and they tend to deny the humanity of Jesus. But where there is the group of those who have hold both, and this is among lay people, not just clergy, who have hold both of the divinity and the humanity of Jesus, that's the group, again, most likely to be clear in terms of understanding the gospel, most likely to be open to the world, most likely to be non-hostile, non-prejudiced, to be able to interrelate or interact with their world in a compassionate, warm fashion. It may be fortuitous, or it may be provident, that we have now available in English a translation of Timothy's treatise on the unity of the two natures of Jesus. But it could not, in terms of our data, have appeared at a more propitious time than right now. If you ask me, for my judgment as to what is a prime theological task out of our data, my judgment is to allow our people to experience what it means to have a Lord, a Christ, a Savior who is their brother in the flesh. Yes, sir. Okay, first I would say we didn't organize the data this way. The people did, in terms of the responses. Secondly, in terms of the question about causation, It is true that with this kind of survey data that is basically cross-sectional, not longitudinal, we're not able to make a very solid causal claim. That's just in terms of science. Of course, cause and effect or causality is a cosmic bellyache for science generally. It's a bellyache for the physicist as well as the psychologist. And we have lots of problems with it. We don't know much about it. But in terms of what we are able to do that is logically and scientifically respectable about the question of cause and effect with the kind of data that we have, I think I can say we have support for the causal suggestion. We use the procedure called automatic interaction detection. I won't go into all of the theory and the mathematics behind it, but in social science data literature, that's about as close as you can get to trying to find out what causes what. And by that kind of analysis, we can say, yes, the dimensions that are clearly a law orientation have a causal relationship to prejudice, to hostility, to preservation of the status quo, to alienation, isolation. Yeah. We have information on that kind of relationship. We gather information in relationship to parents in a number of ways. Self comparison about degree of religion, and am I more religious than my mother, more religious than my father, less, and so on. Identification with parents, identification with parents' values, time of father living in the home, mother absence, and all that kind of stuff. And we tried all of that. The only point at which relationship to the parents makes a difference is that we have a correlation between persons who identified with their parents positively, who accepted parental values, who had a close relationship with their parents, also being able to show higher levels of gospel understanding and higher levels of integration of the gospel into their lives in terms of behavior, so that the relationship to parents shows up positively. It does not show up having any effect negatively.